only came along in person when the stakes were high.
Let's move on, Ravenna said.
The grotto in the eastern Telgs is deep in the smoking darkness of the forests. The glades are silent, except for insect chitter, and wreathed with vapor and steam. There are biting centipedes everywhere, some as long as a man's finger, others as long as a man's leg. The air stinks of mildew. Once every 38 days, the rising star comes up at such an angle it forces its pale and famished light in through a natural hole in the rock face outside the grotto. The beams streak in down an 80-degree angle to the azimuth and strike the still fresh water of the pool in the grotto's base, lighting the milky water like a flame behind muslin. Brethren of the fratery cower around the pool after days of ritual starvation and self-flagellation and attempt to interrupt the falling beams with their silver mirrors. At such times, I have observed, they remove the purple velvet patches from their real eyes and place them over their augmetics. Their flashing mirrors reflect many colors of light. Having ingested low seeds and other natural hallucinogenics, they glare into their mirrors and begin to gabble incoherently. Voxographic units, run on battery leads, are set around the grotto to record their ramblings. As the light fades again, the masters of the fratery play back the vox quarters and tease out the future truths or lies that they have been told. The tower, as they approached it, was far larger than they had first imagined. The main structure, splintered and ruined, rose a full half-kilometer into the dark, bruised sky, like an accusing finger. At the base, like the bole of an ancient tree, it thickened and spread into great piers and buttresses that anchored it into the headland. Crumbling stone bridge spans linked the rocky shelf to the nearest piers. There was no way of defining its origin or age, nor the hands, human or otherwise, that had constructed it. Even its purpose was in doubt. According to the scans, it was the only artificial structure on Malinta. Older star maps referred to it simply by means of a symbol that indicated ruin, antique stroke Xenos. As they picked their way through ancient screes of rubble and broken masonry towards the nearest span, the rain began to lash down, pattering on the mud and driving off the raised stonework. The rising wind began to shiver the glossy black ivy and climbing vines clinging in thick mats to the lower walls.
"This message, it told you to come here?" Nail asked.
"What message?"
Nail frowned and looked at the floating chair.
"The message you got."
"I never said anything about a message."
"Oh, come on, fair play," Nail growled. "Why won't you tell us what we're getting into here?"
"Harlan."
Ravenna's voice sliced into Nail's mind, and he winced slightly. Ravenna's telepathy was sometimes painfully sharp when he was troubled or preoccupied. Nail realized that Ravenna's thought voice was directed at him alone, a private word the others couldn't hear.
"Trust me, old friend. I dare tell you nothing until I'm sure of what we're dealing with. If it turns out to be a trick, you could be biased by misinformation."
"I'm no amateur,"
Nail countered. The others looked at him, hearing only his side of the conversation.
"I know, but you're a loyal man. Loyalty sometimes blinds us. Trust me on this."
"What in the name of the Golden Throne was that?"
Thonius said abruptly. They'd all heard it. Ravenna and Kiss had felt it. High in the ruined summit of the tower, something had screamed. Loud, hideous, inhuman, drawn out. More screams from other non-human voices answered it. Each resounded both acoustically and psychically. The air temperature dropped sharply. Sheens of ice crackled into view, caking the upper sweep of the walls. They moved on a few meters. The keening wails grew louder, whooping and circling within the high walls, as if screaming avian things were flying around inside. As lightning accompanies thunder, so each scream was accompanied by a sympathetic flash of light. The psychic shrieks seemed to draw the storm down, until a halo of flashing, jagged light coruscated in the sky above the tower. Corpuscent danced along the walls like white fluorescent balls. Kiss, her psi-sensitive mind, feeling it worse than the rest, paused to wipe fresh blood off her lip with the back of her Gwell-skin glove. Her nose was bleeding. As she did so, the hostiles began trying to kill them again. The divine fratery, may the Ordos condemn their sick souls, seek to chart the future. All possible futures, in fact. With their mirrors and their abominably practiced eyes, they identify events to come, and take special interest in those events that are ill-favored. Disasters, plagues, invasions, collapses of governments, heresies, famines, defeats in battle. Doom in any guise. The masters of the fratery then disseminate the details of their oracles to the lower orders of their cult. By my estimation, the fratery numbers several thousand, many of them apparently upstanding imperial citizens, spread through hundreds of worlds in the subsectors Antimar, Helicon, Angelus, and Ophidian. Once a prospect, as they call them, has been identified, certain portions of the cult membership are charged with doing everything they can to ensure that it comes to pass, preferably in the worst and most damaging way possible. If a plague is foreseen, then cult members will deliberately break quarantine orders to ensure that the outbreak spreads. If the prospect is a famine, they will plant incendiary bombs or biotoxins in the munitorum grain stores of the threatened world. A heretic emerges, they will protect him and publish his foul lies abroad. An invasion approaches, they are the fifth column that will destroy the defenders from within. They seek doom. They seek to undermine the fabric of our imperium, the culture of man, and cause it to founder and fall. They seek galactic apocalypse, an age of darkness and fire, wherein their unholy masters, the ruinous powers, can rise up and take governance of all. 5 times now I have thwarted their efforts. They hate me, and wish me dead. Now I seek to derail their efforts a 6th time, here, tonight, on Malinta. I have journeyed far out of my way, pursued by their murder bands, to carry a warning. For I have seen their latest prospect with my own eyes, and it is a terrible thing. Laser fire scorched across the mossy span of the bridge arch, sizzling in the rain. Some of it came from the ruin ahead, some from the crags behind them. Stonework shattered and split. Lasbolts and hard rounds snapped and stung away from the age-polished cobbles. "Go!" yelled Nail, turning back towards the crags and firing his weapon in a two-handed brace. At his side, Kara Swole kicked her assault weapon into life. It bucked like a living thing, spitting spent casings out in a sideways flurry. They backed across the bridge as the others ran ahead. Mathewin and Kiss led the way, into the gunfire coming out of the dim archways and terraces ahead. Mathewin's rotator cannon squealed, and flames danced around the spinning barrels. Stone debris and shorn ivy fluttered off the wounded walls. Kiss saw a man, almost severed at the waist, drop from an archway into the lightless gulf below the bridge. Ravenna and Thonius came up behind them. Thonius was still gazing up at the screamlight, tearing and dancing around the tower overhead. He had one hand raised, as if to protect his face from the bullets and laser fire whipping around him.
"Concentrate."
"Yes, yes, of course," Thonius replied.
Mathewin ran under the first arch into the gloom of the tower chambers. His augmetic eyes, little coals of red hardlight gleaming inside his lids, immediately adjusted to the light conditions, and revealed to him the things hidden in the shadows. He pivoted left and mowed down 4 hostiles with a sustained belch of cannon fire. More shot at him. Kiss ran in beside him. She had a las pistol harnessed at her waist, but she hadn't drawn it. She extended the heels of her palms, and 4 kind blades slipped out of the sheaths built into the forearms of her shirt.
Each was thin, razor-sharp, 12 centimeters long, and lacked handles. She controlled them with her mind, orbiting them around her body in wide, buzzing circuits, in a figure of eight, like some lethal human orrery. A hostile opened fire directly at her with an auto-pistol, cracking off 4 shots. Without flinching, she faced them, circling a pair of the blades so they intercepted and deflected the first 2 shots. The second 2 she bent wide with her mind, so that they sailed off harmlessly, like swatted flies. Before he could fire again, Kiss pinned the hostile to the stone wall with the 3rd kind blade. Mathewin was firing again.
"You all right there, Kiss?"
he yelled over the cannon's roar.
"Fine," she smiled.
She was in her element. Dealing death in the name of the Emperor, punishing his enemies, was all she lived for. She was a secretive being. Patience Kiss was not her real name, and none of the band knew what she'd been baptized. She'd been born on Sameter, in the Helican sub, and had grown to womanhood on that filthy, brow-beaten world. Things had happened to her there, things that had changed her and made her Patience Kiss, the Telekine killer. She never spoke of it. The simple fact was, she had faced and beaten a miserable death, and now she was paying death back, in the God Emperor's name, with souls more deserving of annihilation. With a jerk of her mind, she tugged the kindblade out of the pinned corpse and flew it back to join the others. They whistled as they spun, deflecting more gunfire away from her. 5 more hostiles lay ahead, concealed behind mouldering pillars. With a nasal grunt, she sped the kindblades away from her. They shot like guided missiles down the terraceway, arching around obstacles, whipping around the pillars. 4 of the hostiles fell, slashed open by the hurtling blades. The 5th she yanked out of cover with her telekinesis and shot. Now, at last, the gun was in her hands. Inexorable as a planet moving along its given path, Ravenna floated into the gloom, passing between Kiss and Mathewin as the ex-bounty hunter hosed further mayhem at the last of the hostiles on his side. Thonius ran up alongside him.
"What now?" the interrogator asked hopefully. "At least we're out of that ghastly rain."
Screamlight echoed and flashed through the tower from far above, reverberating the structure to its core. Kiss shuddered involuntarily. Her nose was bleeding again.
"Carl. Zeph."
Ravenna's mind voice was quiet, as if he too was suffering the side effects of the psychic screams.
"Rearguard, please. Make sure Kara and Harlan make it in alive."
"But—"
Thonius complained. Mathewin was already running back to the archway.
"Do as I say, Carl."
"Yes, Inquisitor,"
replied Thonius. He turned and hurried after Mathewin.
"With me, please, Patience."
Kiss had just retrieved her kind blades. She held out her arms to let them slide back into her cuff sheaths. The concentrated activity had drained her telekinetic strength, and the terrible screamlight from above had sapped her badly.
"Are you up to this?"
Kiss raised her las pistol.
"I was born up for this, Gideon," she grinned.
"The prospect is, as most are, vague. There are no specifics. However, it is regarded as 100% certainty by the masters of the Frattery that a demonic abomination is about to be manifested into the material universe. This, they predict, will come to pass between the years 400 and 403.M41. Emperor protect us, it may have already happened. There are some details. The crucial event that triggers the manifestation will happen on Eustace Majoris, the overcrowded and dirty capital world of the Angelus subsector, within those aforementioned dates. It may, at the time, seem a minor event, but its consequences will be vast. Hundreds may die. Thousands, mayhap millions, if it is not stopped. The demon will take human form and walk the worlds of the Imperium undetected. It has a name, phonetically Slight, perhaps Slight with a Y, or Slight with a G. It must be stopped. Its birth must be prevented. All I have done in my long career in service of the Ordos, all I have achieved, will be as nothing if this demon comes into being."
"It's getting a little uncomfortable out here,"
Nail remarked. A las shot had just scored across the flesh of his upper arm, but he didn't even wince.
"Agreed," said Kara, ejecting another spent clip onto the cobbles of the span and slamming in a fresh one. They'd been backing away steadily under fire, and now the archway was tantalizingly close. They ducked their heads instinctively as heavy fire ripped out of the archway behind them and peppered the landward's end of the bridge span. Mathewin was covering them at last. They turned and ran into cover, bullets and lasfire chasing their heels. Inside the archway, Thonius was waving them on. Mathewin's cannon ground dry, and he paused to pop out the ammo drum and slap in a fresh one from the handy pouches around his waist. Nail bent in the shadows and reloaded his pistol quickly, expertly. He looked up and stared out into the torrential rain. In the dark of the storm and the swiftly falling night, he counted at least 9 muzzle flashes barking their way.
"How many?"
he asked. This time Mathewin didn't answer. He turned his stony, hard-like gaze towards Kara and raised an eyebrow.
15,
she said at once.
15, mused Nail. "That's 5 each."
"Hey," said Thonius, "there are 4 of us here."
"I know," Nail grinned, "but it's still 5 each, unless you intend to surprise us."
"You little bastard,"
snapped Thonius. He raised his weapon and pinked off several shots at the enemy across the span.
Said Nail. "Still 15.
Kara, can you join us?"
"On my way, boss," said Kara Swole. She grinned at Nail. "Can you deal here? I mean, now it's 7.5 each."
"Get on,"
Nail said. He started firing. Kara dashed off into the darkness behind them. Thonius blasted away again. They all saw a hostile on the far side of the bridge, through the rain, tumble and pitch off the crag.
"There!"
Thonius said triumphantly.
7 each, then, Mathewin remarked to Nail.
The divine frattery, as I have learned, find it particularly easy to identify in their prospects others who have dabbled in far-seeing and clairvoyance. It is as if such individuals somehow illuminate their life courses by toying with the future. The bright track of one has attracted their particular attention. It is through him, and the men and women around him, that the prospect of the manifestation has come to light. He will cause it. Him, or one of those close to him. That is why I have taken it upon myself to warn him. For he is my friend, my pupil, my interrogator. Kiss hadn't seen or even sensed the cultists behind the next archway. Ravener, gliding forwards without hesitation, pulped all 4 of them with his chair's built-in psi cannons. Kiss followed him, striding through lakes of leaking blood and mashed tissue. She was worn out. The constant screams were getting to her. They heard footfalls behind them. Kara Swole ran into view. Kiss lowered her weapon.
"You called for me?"
"Indeed I did, Kara. I can't get up there."
Kara looked up into the gloomy rafters and beams above them.
"No problem."
She took off her coat. Beneath it, she was dressed in a simple matte green body glove.
"Hey, Kara."
"Luck," called Kiss. Kara smiled. She limbered up for a moment, and then leapt up into the rafters, gripping the mouldering wood and gaining momentum. Rapidly, all her acrobat skills coming back to her, she ascended, hand over hand, leaping from beam to beam, defying the dreadful gulf beneath her. She was getting increasingly close to the flitting source of the screenlight. Her pulse raced. Grunting, she somersaulted again and landed on her feet on a cross-member. Kara stood for a moment, feeling the streaming rain slick down over her from the tower's exposed roof. She stuck out her hands for balance, the assault weapon tightly cinched under her bosom. There was a light above her, shining out from a stairless doorway in the shell of the tower. Faint, artificial light, illuminating the millions of raindrops as they hurtled down the empty tower shaft towards her.
"Seeing this?" she asked.
"Yes. Yes, Kara."
"What you expected?"
"I have no idea."
"Here goes," she said, and jumped into space, into rainfall, into air.
A hesitation, on the brink, dark depths below her. Then
She seized a rotting timber beam and swung, her fingers biting deep into the damp, flaking wood. She pivoted in the air and flew up into the doorway, feet first. She landed firmly, balanced, arms wide. A figure stood before her in the ruined tower room, illuminated by a single hovering glow globe.
"Hello, Kara," the figure said. "It's been a long time."
She gasped.
"Oh, good Emperor! My master!"
The man was tall, shrouded in a dark leather coat that did not quite conceal the crude augmetics supporting his frame. His head was bald, his eyes dark-rimmed. He leaned heavily on a metal staff. Rainwater streaming off him, Inquisitor Gregor Eisenhorn gazed at her. Down at the archway, Thonius recoiled in horror.
"I think we have a problem," he said.
"Don't be such a pussy," Nail said.
"Actually, I think he might be right," said Methuen. "That's not good, is it?"
Nail craned his neck to look. Something blocky and heavy was striding towards them over the bridge span. It was metal and solid, machined striding limbs, hissing steam from piston bearings. Its arms were folded against the sides of its torso like the wings of a flightless bird. Those arms, each one a heavy las cannon, began to cough and spit. Massive hydraulic absorbers soaked up the recoil. The archway collapsed in a shower of exploding masonry. Nail, Thonius, and Methuen fled into the cover of the gallery behind.
"Emperor, save me!" Nail exclaimed. "They've got a bloody dreadnought!"
Rainwater dripped off Eisenhorn's nose.
"Gideon, is he with you, Kara?" he asked.
"Yes, he is," she stammered. "Thrawn, it's good to see you."
"And you, my dear.
But it's important I speak to Gideon."
Kara nodded.
"Where me?" she said.
Far below, Ravenna heard her. Kara Swole stiffened, her eyes clouding. The wraithbone pendant at her throat glowed with a dull, ethereal light. She wasn't Kara Swole anymore. Her body was possessed by the mind of Gideon Ravenna.
"Hello, Gregor,"
Kara's mouth said.
"Gideon. Well met.
I was worried you wouldn't come."
"And ignore its summons from my mentor? Phrased in glossia? Thorn wishes Talon. I was hardly going to ignore that."
"I thought you would appreciate a taste of the old private code," said Eisenhorn. His frozen face failed to show the smile he was feeling.
"How could I forget it, Thorn? You drummed it into me."
Eisenhorn nodded. "Much effort getting here?" Kara's lips conveyed Ravenna's words.
"Some. An effort made to kill us. Nail is holding them off at the gateway to the tower."
"Old Harlan, eh?"
Eisenhorn said.
"Ever dependable. You've got a good man there, Gideon. A fine man. Give him my respects. And Kara, too. Best there is."
"I know, Gregor."
A strangely intense expression that wasn't her own appeared on Kara's face.
"I think it's time you told me why you brought me here."
"Yes, it is. But in person, I think. That would be best. That way you can stop subjecting Kara to that effort of puppeting, and we can be more private. I'll come down to you."
"How? There are no stairs."
"The same way I got up here,"
Eisenhorn said. He looked upwards into the rain hosing down through the broken roof.
"Cherubel,"
he whispered. Something nightmarish in the strobing scream light answered him. Its pitted steel hull glossy with rain, the dreadnought strode through the shattered archway. The booming storm threw its hulking shadow 100 jagging directions at once with its lightning. Its massive cannon pods pumped pneumatically as they retched out streams of lasbolts. The weapons made sharp, barking squeals as they discharged, a repeating note louder than the storm. Behind it, 3 dozen armed brethren of the Divine Frattery charged across the bridge span. Stone split and fractured under the bombardment. Pillars that had stood for eons teetered and collapsed like felled trees, spraying stone shards across the terrace flooring. Nail, Methuen, and Thonius retreated into the empty inner chambers of the ruined tower. Even Mathwin's rotator couldn't so much as dent the dreadnought's armor casing. "Someone really, really wants us dead," Thonius said.
"Us, or the person we came here to meet," Nail countered.
They hurried down a dim colonnade, and Nail shoved both his comrades into the cover of a side arcade as cannon fire, bright as sunbursts, sizzled down the chamber.
"Golden throne! There's got to be something we can try," Nail said.
Mathwin reached into his coat pocket and pulled out three close-focus frag grenades. He held them like a market seller would hold apples or ploins. It was just like Mathwin to bring a pocket full of explosives. He never felt properly dressed unless he was armed to the back teeth.
"Don't suppose you've got a mini-nuke in the other pocket?" asked Thonius.
"My other suit's at the cleaners," Mathwin replied.
"They'll have to do," said Nail. "We'll go with what we got."
He looked around. They could hear the heavy clanking footfalls of the dreadnought bearing down on them, the hiss of its hydraulic pistons, the whir of its motivators.
"They may not even crack the thing's plating," Mathwin remarked.
As well as a supply of ridiculous ordnance, Zeph Mathwin could always be relied on for copious pessimism.
"We'll have to get them close," said Thonius.
"We,"
said Nail. He'd already taken one of the grenades and was weighing it up like a ball.
"Yes, Mr. Nail, we."
Thonius took another of the grenades, holding between finger and thumb as if it was a potentially venomous insect. He really wasn't comfortable with the physicality of fighting. Thonius could hack cogitators and archive stacks faster than any of them, and could rewrite codes that any of the rest didn't even understand. He was Ravenna's interrogator because of his considerable intellect, not his killing talents. That's why Ravenna employed the likes of Nail and Mathwin.
"Three of us, three bombs," Thonius stated. "We're all in this together. I'm not going to be pulped by that thing without having a go at stopping it myself."
Nail looked dubiously at Mathwin.
"It's not up for debate, you vulgarians," Thonius said snottily. "Don't make me remind you I'm technically in charge here."
"Oh, that would explain why we're technically nose deep in crap," Nail said.
A thick section of stone wall blew in nearby, hammered to fragments by withering cannon fire. The massive weight of the dreadnought crushed heat-brittled stone to dust as it stomped through the gap. The trio began to run again, down the next terrace, trying to put some distance between them and the killing machine.
"Get ahead," Mathwin said. "I'll take the first pop."
Nail nodded and grabbed hold of Thonius, who was still puzzling over his grenade, figuring out how to adjust the knurled dial to set the timer. Nail got the interrogator into cover. Thonius straightened his sleeves.
"If you've pulled my coat out of shape, Nail," he began.
Nail glared at him. Behind them, in the open, Mathwin primed his grenade and turned. As the dreadnought hove into view, he hurled the small, black charge. Kara rejoined Ravenna and Kiss like an ape, swinging down through the rafters and leaping the last few meters. Eisenhorn descended after her. He was being carried by a grotesque figure, a human shape twisted and distended by arcane forces. The thing glowed with an eldritch inner light. Its bare limbs and torso were covered with runes and sigils. Chains dragged from its ankles. It set Eisenhorn's heavy, cumbersome form down on the flagstones.
"Thank you, Cherubael," he said.
The thing, its head lolling brokenly, exposed its teeth in a dreadful smile.
"That's all. I can go back now," it said.
Its voice was like sandpaper on glass.
"There are many more phantoms up there to burn."
"Go ahead," Eisenhorn said. The dreadful demon host zoomed back aloft into the rain-swept heights of the ruin. At once the ghastly screaming began again. Light pulsed and flashed. Eisenhorn faced Ravenna's chair.
"The Frattery has unleashed everything they have tonight to stop me talking to you. Demon hosts of their own. Cherubael has been battling them. I think he's enjoying it."
"He,"
said Ravenna via his chair's voxponder. "Last we met, you called that thing it, my master." Eisenhorn shrugged. His augmetic sighed with the gesture.
"We have reached an understanding. Does that shock you, Gideon?"
"Nothing shocks me any more," said Ravenna.
Good, said Eisenhorn. He looked at Kara and Kiss. We need a moment, Kara. If you and your friend wouldn't mind.
Patience, Kiss, Kiss said, stern and hard.
I know who you are, said Eisenhorn, and turned away with Ravener. In a low voice he began to tell his ex-pupil all he knew about the divine frattery.
Kara, that's Eisenhorn,
Kiss whispered to Kara as they watched the figures withdraw.
Yes,
replied Kara. She was still rather stunned by the meeting, and Ravener's brief wearing had left her tired.
Everything you and Harlan have said about him, I expected...
What?
Something more intimidating. He's just a broken old man, and I can't think why he consorts with a chaos-filth thing like that host form.
Kara shrugged. I don't know about the demon host. He fought it and hated it for so long, and then... I don't know. Maybe he's become the radical, they say. But you are wrong about him being a broken old man. Well, he's broken, and he's old. But I'd rather go up against Ravener unarmed than ever cross Gregor Eisenhorn. Mathewin's grenade exploded. The aim had been good, but the device had bounced oddly at the last moment and had gone off beneath the striding dreadnought. The machine paced on through the ball of fire, untroubled. Mathewin dived for cover as the cannons began pumping again.
Crap. My turn, I suppose, said Nail.
He clicked the setter to 4 seconds, thumbed the igniter, and ran into the hallway, bowling the grenade under arm. Then he threw himself into shelter. The grenade bounced once, lifted with the spin Nail had put on it, and smacked bluntly against the front shell of the dreadnought. It was just rebounding when it detonated. The dreadnought vanished in a sheet of flame that boiled down the hallway, compressed and driven by the walls and roof. As it cleared, Thonius saw the dreadnought. Its front was scorched, but it was far, far from dead.
Damn. Just me, then, he said.
You've dabbled in far-seeing, Eisenhorn said. I know that. Your time spent with the Eldar drew you in that direction. I won't deny it, Ravener replied. That makes you bright to the Frattery, said Eisenhorn. It illuminates you in the interwoven pathways of the future. That's why they located you in their prospects. Ravener was quiet for a moment. And you've come all this way, risked all this danger, to warn me. Of course. I'm flattered. Don't be, Gideon. You'd do the same for me. I'm sure I would. But what you're telling me is... crazy. Eisenhorn bowed his head and ran the fingers of his right hand up and down the cold grip of his runestaff. Of course it sounds crazy, he said. But it's true. I ask you this. If you don't believe me, why are these cultist fools trying so hard to prevent our meeting here tonight? They know it's true. They want you denied of this warning. That I will trigger this manifestation, this demon birth. You, or one close to you. The trigger point is something that happens on Eustace Majoris. Within his forced chair, Ravener was numb. I won't lie, Gregor. My current investigations focus on that world. I was en route to Eustace Majoris when I diverted to meet you here, but I have no knowledge of this slight. It hasn't figured in any of my research. I can't believe that something I will do, or something one of my band will do, will... Gideon, I can't believe my only ally these days is a demon host. Fate surprises us all. So what should I do, now you've warned me? Abandon my investigations on Eustace. Shy away from that world in the hope that by avoiding it, I can also avoid this prophecy. Eisenhorn's face was in shadow.
Maybe you should.
No, said Ravener. What I should be is careful. Careful in my own actions, careful to oversee the actions of my team. If there is a truth in the Frattery's prophecy,
it is surely bound up in the dire conspiracy I am just now uncovering on Eustace Majoris. But I must prosecute that case. I would be failing in the duty you charged me with if I didn't. After all, the future is not set. We make it, don't we?
I think we do. I hope we do.
Gregor, when have either of us shirked from serving the throne just because we're afraid things might go bad? We are inquisitors. We seek. We do not hide. Eisenhorn raised his head and let the falling raindrops patter off his upraised palm.
Gideon, I came to warn you. Nothing else. I never expected you to change your course. Now, at least, you're aware of a might-be. You can be ready for it. That's all I wanted. Far behind them, the sound of rapid cannon fire and dull explosions echoed through the tower. I think the time for conversation is over, said Eisenhorn.
Thonius's pockets were not full of munitions and ordnance like Mathewin's, but he reached into them anyway. In one, a mini-cogitator, in another, two data slates. In a third, a clasped leather case in which he had wrapped his tools, files, data pins, fine brushes, tubes of lubricant, a vial of adhesive, pliers and tweezers, all the bric-a-brac that aided him in conquering and tinkering with cogitators and codifiers.
"Carl, get into cover!" Nail was yelling.
Thonius slid out the vial of adhesive and wiped the drooling nozzle down the side of the grenade ball, waiting a moment for it to get contact tacky. Then, taking a deep breath, he leapt out of cover into the face of the dreadnought and lobbed the grenade. It hit the front casing and adhered there, stuck fast. Mathewin threw himself out of cover and tackled Thonius, bringing him down behind a pillar. The grenade exploded.
"You see," said Thonius, "you see how thinking works."
But the dreadnought wasn't finished. The blast had split its belly plates, but it was still moving, still striding, still firing. Thonius shrugged.
"All right, we're dead."
The dreadnought suddenly stopped blasting. It faltered. A chill swept over the chamber. Ravenna's chair slid into view, heading towards the killer machine. With the force of his mind, he had momentarily jammed its weapons. Sudden frost coated the walls, Ravenna's chair, and the dreadnought. The machine tried to move. Cycling mechanisms shuddered as it attempted to clear its guns. A tall figure strode past Ravenna, heading for the dreadnought. It held a rune staff in one hand and a drawn sword in the other. Its robes fluttered out behind it, stiff with ice.
"Holy Terra!" exclaimed Nail. "Eisenhorn!"
A second before Ravenna's mental grip failed, a second before the cannons resumed their murderous work, Eisenhorn swung the sword, Barbarisata, and cleft the dreadnought in two. The sword blade ripped along the fissure Thonius's cunning grenade had put in it. Eisenhorn turned aside and shielded his face as the dreadnought combusted. He looked back at them all, terrible and majestic, backlit by flames.
"Shall we?" he said.
With the dreadnought gone, the remainder of the Frattery force fled. The warband and the two inquisitors slaughtered many as they made their escape into the storm. Tugging one of her kind blades out of a body with her mind, Kiss watched Eisenhorn ripping his way through the faltering hostiles around them.
"Now I see what you mean," she said to Kara Swole.
"I'm done here," Gregor Eisenhorn said.
He looked back across the bridge span to the tower. Screamlight was still dancing around the summit.
"Cherubeo needs my help now. I should go and see how he's doing."
"I will be vigilant," Ravenna said. Eisenhorn knelt and pressed his gnarled hands flat against the side of the chair.
"The Emperor go with you. I've said my piece. It's up to you now, Gideon."
Eisenhorn rose and looked at the others.
"Mademoiselle Kiss, interrogator, Mr. Mathewin, a pleasure meeting you."
He nodded to each of them.
"Kara?"
She smiled.
"Gregor?"
"Never a hardship seeing you. Look after Gideon for me."
"I will."
Eisenhorn looked at Harlan Nail
and held out a hand. Nail clasped it with both of his.
Harlan, like old times. Emperor protect you, Gregor.
I hope so, Eisenhorn said, and walked away, back across the bridge span towards the tower where the scream light still flashed and sparked. They knew they would not see him again. Unless the future was not as set as it seemed. Malinta fell away below them, vast and silent. Nail piloted the transport into low orbit, flashing out signals to their ship. Once the nav was set and automatics had taken over, he turned his chair on its pivot and looked at Ravenna.
He wasn't the same, he said.
How do you mean?
He seemed so sane. I thought he was mad.
Yes, I thought that too. It's hard to know whether I should believe him.
About what?
About the dangers ahead, Harlan. The risks we may take.
So, what do?
We carry on. We do our best. We serve the Emperor of Mankind. If what Gregor said comes to pass, we deal with it. Unless you have a better idea.
Not a one,
replied Nail, turning back to study the controls.
Good,
sent Ravenna, and wheeled his chair around, returning to the cabin space behind where the others were gathered. Nail sighed and looked ahead at the turning starfields. The future lay ahead. It's back to them, saying nothing. That was Thorn Wishes Talon, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth. The Gardens of Tycho, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth. The nature of Master Delac's line of business had never come up in conversation, and Valentin Drusha was in no position to ask impertinent questions. Certainly, Master Delac was a successful man, one of the most conspicuously wealthy citizens on that dusty stretch of the Bone Coast. Drusha had an idea or two, but decided it was probably safer not to know. He just did what he was told. 2 visits a week, after hours, to Master Delac's mansion up in the hills, providing his specialist services on a private basis, in return for an agreed wage, and no questions asked, either way. Sometimes Master Delac would supplement Drusha's payment with a gift, a smoked ham, a packet of expensive, dainty biscuits, perhaps even a bottle of imported wine. Drusha knew he could get good prices selling these items on later, but he always kept them for himself. It wasn't that he was greedy, or some kind of epicure, although, Throne knows, it had been a long, long time since Valentin Drusha had known any luxury in his life. It was simply because there was a line Drusha wasn't prepared to cross. So many aspects of his life, his respectability and his good character, had been eroded over the years. He held on tight to those he still had. Besides, he was a meek man, and he was too afraid of getting caught. Late one launday evening, Drusha was making the return journey from Delac's house to Callister. Drusha went to and from the mansion on foot, a solid journey of an hour each way. Delac never offered him transport, even though he had a driver. Drusha tried to consider the bi-weekly trips the sort of decent exercise a man of his age ought to be getting, but by the time he returned to his habitat on Amon Street, he was always weary. The sun had gone, leaving the sky over the small coastal town stained like pink marble. A night wind was picking up, sifting white dust from the dunes across the town road, and Callister itself seemed shuttered and dark. There was no nightlife, no remission from the frugal, small-town quiet. But, in addition to the payment in his coat pocket, Drusha carried a piece of good brisket in his satchel. He would eat well for the next few nights, at least. Amon Street was a tenement slope, running down from Aquila Square to the rusty wharfs and the condemned fishworks. The buildings were drab brown with age and neglect, and their roofs were in need of repair. The air in the street stank because of the lime burners just across the way. Drusha rented rooms on the 4th floor of number 70. A large black transporter with big chrome headlamps was parked just down the street. Drusha noticed it as he was fumbling for his key, but paid it little heed. He went up the narrow wooden staircase to his door. It was only when he stepped into his little room he realized someone was already there. The man was robust and rather ugly, Heavy-browed, with a shock of thick, dark hair and a shapeless, asymmetric face, he wore a thick, high-buttoned suit of black serge and a heavy leather storm coat, also black. He was seated, casually, on the wooden pole-back chair behind the door, waiting.
"What are you—"
Drusha began, his voice coming out thin and reedy.
"You Drusha?"
the man asked.
"Yes. Why? What are you doing here? This is my—"
"Valentin Drusha,"
the man pressed, glancing at a small data slate in his left hand.
"Magos biologist. Says here you're 47. Is that right? You look older."
"I am Valentin Drusha,"
Drusha replied, too scared to be offended.
"What is this about? Who are you?"
"Sit down, Magos. Over there, please. Put your satchel on the table."
Drusha did as he was told. His pulse was thumping, and his skin had become clammy. He had an awful feeling he knew what this was about.
"I'm Falcon," the man said, and briefly flashed an identity warrant at him.
Drusha swallowed as he glimpsed the silver seal of the Magistratum, attached to which was a small orange ribbon that denoted the Martial Order Division.
"How long have you been here on Gershom?"
14 years. 14 years this winter."
"And here, in Callister?"
"Just 18 months.
The man looked at his data slate again.
"According to central records, you are employed by the Administratum to teach natural history at the local Skolam."
"That's correct. My papers are in order."
"But you're a Magos biologist, not a teacher."
"Employment prospects on this world are not great for a man of my calling. I take what work I can. The teaching stipend offered by the Administratum keeps a roof over my head."
The man pursed his lips.
"If the employment prospects for your kind are thin on the ground, Magos, it begs the question why you came to Gershom in the first place, let alone why you chose to stay here for 14 years.
Despite his fear, Drusha felt piqued. This was the old injustice again, back to haunt him.
"When I came to this world, sir, I was gainfully employed. The Lord Governor himself was my patron. He commissioned me to produce a complete taxonomy of the planet's fauna. The work took 7 years, but at the end of it, complications arose."
"Complications?"
"A legal matter. I was forced to stay on for another 2 years as a witness. All the money I had earned from the commission ran out. By the time the case was settled, I could no longer afford passage to another world. I have been here ever since, making a living as best I can."
The man, Falcon, didn't seem very interested. In Drusha's experience, no one ever was. On a downtrodden outworld like Gershom, everyone had their own sob story.
"You keep glancing at your satchel, Magos," Falcon remarked suddenly. "Why is that?"
Drusha swallowed hard again. He had never been any good at lying.
"Sir," he said quietly, "could you tell me? I mean, would things go better for me if I made a full confession now?"
Falcon blinked, as if surprised, then smiled.
"That's a good idea,"
he said, sitting down to face Drusha across the low table where the satchel sat.
"Why don't you do just that?"
"I'm not proud of this," said Drusha. "I mean, it was stupid. I knew the Magistratum would find out eventually. It's just, things have been so tight."
"Go on."
"The Administratum pays me a stipend for my services, along with certain ration benefits as per the martial order. This is, of course, contingent on me not supplementing my earnings."
"Naturally,"
nodded Falcon.
"If you break the terms, there is a penalty. It can be severe."
Drusha sighed, and showed Falcon the contents of his satchel.
"There is a man, a local businessman, who employs me 2 evenings a week. It is a private arrangement. He pays me in cash, no questions asked."
"How much?"
2 crowns per evening. He has a daughter. For her, he retains my services."
Falcon looked at the things Drusha was showing him.
"You do this with his daughter?"
"Yes. Sometimes he watches."
Falcon got up.
"I see. This is a pretty picture, isn't it?"
For some reason, Falcon seemed to be stifling a smile, as if something amused him terribly.
"Am I in serious trouble?" Drusha asked.
"You'll have to come with me," Falcon said. "To Tycho."
"To Tycho?"
"The Marshal wants to speak with you."
"Oh, Throne,"
Drusha gasped.
I thought perhaps a fine.
Pack your things, Magos. All of them. I'll give you 5 minutes.
Drusha had very few belongings. They fitted into 2 small bags. Falcon didn't offer to carry either of them down to the transporter. It was dark now. Fully night. When the transporter's engine turned over, the glare of the headlights filled the depths of Amon Street. Drusha sat up front, beside the magistratum officer. They drove up through the town, onto the coast highway, and turned south. The cities of the southern peninsula, Tycho amongst them, had been the arena of a savage civil war that had raged for over 10 years. The popular separatist movement had finally been defeated by government forces 2 years earlier, but by then the war had critically weakened Gershom's already ailing economy. Strict imperial martial order had been imposed throughout the peninsula and right up through the Bone Coast into the eastern provinces. The civil war had stained the air with smoke and poisoned the coastal waters, killing off the fishing industry. The cities of the peninsula were urban ruins where the Martial Order Division worked to re-establish Imperium law and support the impoverished civilian population. Falcon drove for 2 hours without speaking. The vox set under his dashboard turned down, crackled with magistratum traffic as if it were talking in its sleep. Drusha stared out of the window at the darkness and the occasional black ruin that loomed out of it. This was it, he felt. Gershom was his nemesis. It had lured him in, a bright young man with an equally bright future before him, and it had trapped him like a fettle fly in amber. It had drained him dry, throttled his spirit, made him destitute. And now this, after all his efforts to earn a crust to live, let alone a ticket off-world, it was going to destroy him. Disgrace, shame, perhaps a custodial sentence. I don't deserve this, he murmured.
What's that?
Asked Falcon at the wheel.
Nothing.
They began to pass through armoured roadblocks where magistratum troopers wearing the orange ribbon of the Martial Order Division waved Falcon through. They were entering the peninsula proper, the real war zone. Ghost cities, tumbled and forlorn, drifted past, lit by searchlights and military beacons. The dark landscape outside the transporter became a phosphorescent waste of fragile walls and empty habs. Tycho was the principal city of the peninsula region, and when they drove in through its empty streets, 4 hours after leaving Callister, Drusha saw a miserable calamity of twisted girders, piled rubble, and smoke-blackened buildings. His face, half lit by the luminous dials of the dashboard, reflected back to him off the window, superimposed on the ruins. Pale, thin, bespectacled, the hair thin and grey. Drusha wasn't sure if he resembled the wastes of Tycho, or if they resembled him. They pulled up outside a mouldering, ouse-like monolith in the city centre.
"Leave your bags," Falcon said, getting out. "I'll have them brought in."
Drusha followed him in through the towering entrance. Magistratum officers hurried to and fro in the echoing atrium, and limp imperial flags hung from the roof. There was a smell of counterseptic.
"This way," Falcon said.
He led Drusha to a room on the 5th floor. The elevators were out, and they had to use the stairs. Falcon made him wait outside the heavy double doors. The hallway was cold, and night air seeped in through the cracked window panes at the far end. Drusha paced up and down. He could hear the rattle and clack of cogitators in nearby rooms, and an occasional shout from down below. Then he heard laughter from behind the double doors. Falcon emerged. He was still chuckling.
"You can go in now," he said.
Drusha walked in, the doors closing behind him. The office was large and grim, a single metal desk planted on the threadbare rug. Half a dozen wire basket carts, heavily laden with dog-eared dossiers and files. A cogitator whirring to itself. Faded spaces on the walls where pictures had once hung.
"Thrall, I wouldn't have recognized you, Magos," said a voice.
She was standing by the deep windows, silhouetted against the nighttime city outside. He knew the voice at once.
"Max?"
Jermaine Max stepped forwards to meet him, a smile on her lips. Her hair was still short, her face still lean, the old tiny zigzag scar above the left-hand side of her mouth still visible. The other, newer scar on her forehead was half hidden under her fringe.
"Hello, Valentin," she said. "What's it been now? 5 years? More?"
He nodded.
"Deputy Max."
She shook her head. "It's Magistrate and Marshal Max now. Chief of Martial Order, Tycho City." He stiffened.
"Mademoiselle, I can explain everything. I hope the fact that you know me of old might mitigate the—"
"Falcon was playing with you, Magas."
"Excuse me, what?"
Max sat down behind her desk.
"I sent Falcon up the coast to get you. Throne knows why you started confessing things to him. Guilty conscience, Valentin?"
"I—" Drusha stammered.
"Falcon was beside himself. He told me he didn't think he could keep a straight face on the journey down here."
"Did you think you were in trouble?"
"He— that is, I—"
"Teaching the daughter of some small-time racketeer the art of watercolor painting? To supplement the pittance admin pays you? Come on, Valentin. I'd hardly spare a chief investigator to go all that way to bring you in, you criminal mastermind, you."
Drusha felt a little giddy. "May I sit down?" he asked.
She nodded, still chuckling, and reached into a desk drawer for a bottle of Amasek and 2 shot glasses. "Get this inside you, you filthy recidivist," she grinned, handing 1 glass to him.
"I really don't understand what's going on," Drusha said.
"Neither do I," she said. "That's why I want some help. Some expert help. I said you weren't in trouble, and I was lying. You're not in personal trouble, but there is trouble here, and I'm about to drop you right in it."
"Oh," he said.
"Drink up," Max said. "You'll need it where we're going."
"In your expert opinion," she said, "what did that—"
Drusha took a long, slow look, then excused himself. Coming up, the Amasek was a lot hotter and more acid than it had felt going down.
"All right," she said.
He wiped his mouth and nodded reluctantly. Max took a little pot out of her uniform pocket and smeared what looked like grease at her nose. She reached out and did the same to Drusha. The fierce camphor smell of Oskil filled his sinuses.
"Should have done that before I took you in," Max apologized. "Old Medicaid mortis trick. It masks the stench of decay."
She led him back into the morgue. The place was chilly and tiled with mauve enamel squares. There were brass plug holes every few meters across the floor, and in the distance Drusha could hear water pattering from a leaky scrub hose. High-gain glow strips, sharp and white, filled the chamber with a light like frost. The cadaver lay on a steel gurney beside an autopsy unit. Other shapes, tagged and covered in red sheets, lurked nearby on other trolleys.
"All right to take another look?" Max asked.
Drusha nodded. She folded the red shroud back. The man was naked, his body as white and swollen as cooked seafood. His hands, feet, and genitals seemed shriveled with cold, and the fingernails stood proud and dark. The hairs on his chest and pubis were black and looked like insect legs. He must have been about 180 in life, Drusha figured, fighting back another wave of nausea. Heavy set. Bruises of lividity marked his lumbar region, and there were other darker blue bruises around his ribs. The front of his face and most of his throat had been bitten away. Parts of the skull structure had gone, along with the soft tissue. Cleanly severed, like industrial shears, had— Drusha gagged and looked aside.
"Animal, right?" Max said.
Drusha mumbled something.
"Was that a yes?"
"It would appear to be a bite,"
Drusha said, his voice very tiny.
"Very deep and strong. And then the suggestion of some feeding around the face and neck."
"Animal, right?" she repeated.
"I suppose. Nothing human could have bitten like that."
"I measured the bite radius, just like you taught me. Remember, in Outer Urdar? I measured it."
"That's good."
20 centimeters. And I checked, too. No tooth fragments. This was clean. I mean, it just bit his face right off."
Drusha turned slowly.
"Max, what am I doing here?"
"Helping my investigation," she said. "I thought we covered that. I'm in charge in this neck of the woods, with plenty enough problems to contend with, I can tell you. And then this crap happens.
I look for an expert, and lo and behold, I find Magus biologist Valentin Drusha, my old pal, working as a teacher in Callister. So I thought, Max, that's perfect. We worked together so well before, and this clearly needs a biologist expert.
That's great.
Valentin, cheer up. There's money in this. I'll bill your hours out to the magistratum, and you'll get 3 times what the administratum was paying you. Expert witness and all.
You're running the martial order program here in Tycho, and you pull strings like that to get me to consider one case.
No, said Max. I should have explained that too, I guess. This isn't the only victim.
How many others?
He asked. Max made a vague gesture that encompassed all the other gurneys in the chamber. 25, 30, maybe more.
You're joking.
I wish I was. Something is chomping its way through the population.
Drusha steeled himself and turned back to the exposed corpse, switching his standard glasses for his reading pair.
A fluorescing lamp, please, and a close glass.
She handed him the glass from the autopsy cart and held the lamp up, bathing the dead man's devastated skull with blue light. Drusha picked up a steel probe and gently excised the lip of one of the revealed bone edges. He fought to keep his gorge down.
No tooth fragments, I told you.
I mean nothing, he said. Not even the bacillus residue one would expect from the wound mark of a predator. This wasn't an animal.
It's not a bite.
What? It's too clean.
I'd say you were looking for a man with a chainsword.
Max shook her head.
No.
Why no?
Because if there was a maniac with a chainsword running around downtown Tycho, I'd know about it. This is an animal, Valentin.
How can you be so sure?
He asked.
Come on, she said. I'll show you.
The headlamps of her transporter picked out the sign over the wrought iron gateway. The Gardens of Tycho.
Well, stocked before the Civil War, she said, pulling on the wheel.
The biggest xenozoological exhibit on the planet. The local governor had a thing about exotic animals.
And?
And, Valentin, it was bombed during the war. Some animals were killed, but many more escaped. I think something from here is roaming the ruins of Tycho, hungry, neglected, killing people.
And that's why, he began.
That's why I need a Magus biologist, she finished. They pulled up and got out. The gardens were dark and quiet. It was still 2 hours before dawn. There was an awful damp reek in the air, emanating from the empty cages and the dank rockcrete pens. Max had given Drusha a stablight and carried one of her own. They walked together, their footsteps gritty and crisp on the ground, playing the beams around. The gardens of Tycho had not been a sophisticated collection. Drusha remembered the spectacular xenofauna halls of Thracian Primaris that he had visited as a young man. There, the pens and enclosures had been encoded to create perfect habitats for the precious specimens, often with their own atmospheres, their own gravities even. Such expertise, and the money to realize it, had not been available on Tycho. These were simple cages, and, in places, armored holding tanks, where exotic creatures from the far-flung corners of the Imperium had lived out their days on Gershom in miserable confinement. Drusha knew exactly how they felt.
If it's been caged like this, Max, it will perhaps have become psychotic, he said.
The animal?
The animal. It's common in poor conditions such as these. Animals held in crude cages often develop behavioral problems. They become unpredictable.
Violent.
But if it's a predator anyway, she began,
even predators have patterns.
The need to hunt, to breed, to territorialize. Limit those things and you break the pattern.
That's important why? She asked.
If this animal is a carnivore, and I would suspect as much, it isn't feeding on its kills.
Well, only minimally.
It is killing simply to kill.
Like the hill beast,
she murmured, thinking back to that haunted winter in Outer Udar.
No, he said. That beast was different. Killing was its behavior. Here we have an aberration.
As they walked further, Drusha began to see the awful damage done in the course of the war. Bomb-shattered pens, mounds of rubble, plasteel cages shorn from their mounting blocks, and bones. There were corpses in the intact pens, too. limp sacks of dried flesh, scattered vertebrae, the lingering stench of dung and decay. A row of wire domes that had once held rare birds was littered with bright feathers. Tufts of down caked the wire mesh, evidence of frantic, starving attempts to be free. They reminded Drusha of Baron Khan's poultry coops.
"We thought everything had died," Max said. "The stink when we first came down here. I mean, nothing had been fed or cleaned out in months. Everything in a sealed cage was dead, except some kind of emaciated dromedary horse, which had been living off its own fat deposits, and even that died a few days after we freed it. And everything in the bombed cages we figured was wiped out, although there are some finch monkeys loose in the lower Bowery, freaking little things, and Falcon swears he saw a grazer on Lemon Street one night, though I say he was drunk. So, if something's loose, it came from the bomb-damaged cages," Drusha said. She shrugged. "Unless some well-intentioned citizen came along during the war and let something out and then locked the cage again. Some of them seem to be empty, though the collection's manifest doesn't say if they were just unstocked pens. It's years out of date."
"You have a manifest?"
Max nodded and produced a data slate from her coat.
"I've highlighted any item that was caged in the bombed area, and also anything connected to an empty cage. Throne, Valentin, I haven't the first clue what half of them are. So glad to have an expert on board."
He started to look at the list.
"So it could have been anything highlighted, or anything at all, given the fact that the stock might have been changed or rotated after this list was made."
She was about to reply when her Voxlink chimed. The sharp little note made Drusha jump. Max took the call.
"We have to go," she said, turning to head back to the exit. "I've been called in. Some drunken idiots brawling in a tavern after curfew."
"Do I have to come?" he said.
She turned back and shone her stab light in his face.
"No. Why, would you like to stay here?"
Drusha glanced around.
"Not really," he said.
They drove through streets that were deserted but for burnt-out vehicles and the occasional magistratum transport rushing off on a response. He sat in the passenger seat, studying the slate, rocked by the jolts of the uneven roadway. Relief was beginning to seep into him, relief that he wasn't bound for disgrace and a custodial sentence after all. A little part of him hated Falcon for his trick, but a greater part of him despised himself for being so foolish. Gershom wasn't his nemesis. Valentin Drusha was his own worst enemy, and his ruined life was testament to the way he had studiously taken every wrong turn destiny had ever offered him.
"Your hair's gone grey," Max said,
her eyes on the road. He looked up. "I stopped dyeing it."
"You dyed your hair?" she asked.
He didn't reply.
"So you've matured out of that vanity then, Valentin?" she smirked.
"No, I just couldn't afford the treatment anymore." She laughed, but he was sure he detected some sympathy in her tone.
"I like it," she said after a while. "It's distinguished."
"You haven't changed at all," he said. She pulled the vehicle to a halt outside a battered townhouse, where magistratum officers were attempting to restrain 9 or 10 brawling men. There was blood on the pavement, and the air was lit by the blinking lamps of the armored patrol vehicles. Max got out.
"Stay here," she said.
She peered back at him through the open door.
"So, is that a good thing?"
"What?"
he asked.
"The fact that I haven't changed."
"I never thought you needed much improvement," he replied, immediately appalled that he'd made such a bold remark out loud. Max laughed, then slammed the door. In the sealed quiet of the transporter, Drusha watched for a while as she waded in with her riot baton and brought order to the scene. Then he turned his attention back to the data slate. Time passed. The driver's door opened, and the transporter rocked on its springs as she clambered back in.
"I think we're looking for a Carnadon," he said.
"Yeah?"
she said, gunning the engine and throwing the vehicle forwards in rapid acceleration.
"Yes, I mean working from the details here. I could be wrong if the specimens were changed after this list was made up, but it's a simple process of elimination."
"Is it?"
she asked, throwing them around a street corner so fast the tires squealed. "There were only 4 predators listed in the bombed-out pens. Discount the Mirepoix tree creeper because it's an injector, not a biter."
"A what?"
"It injects its prey with a long proboscis and dissolves the internal organs, sucking them out."
"Enough. I mean, it doesn't have a mouth." "All right, all right. So no bite wounds."
"Right."
Right, so the Sorapt from Brontotaf is off the list as well. Max changed down and raced them along another empty boulevard. Because? Because it's the size of a hab block. Falcon wouldn't have had to be drunk to spot it already. She grinned. And the Pouncer here, from Lamserot. We can cross that off, too. It's a felid, but far too slight to cause the wounds you showed me. Besides, I doubt it would have lasted long in this climate outside a heated pen. So we're left with the... what did you call it? She asked. Carnadon, from Gudrun. Throne, there shouldn't have been one in captivity here. They're virtually extinct, and listed on the Administratum's prohibition order. It's a felid too, but big, and from temperate habitats. How big? 5 or 6 meters, maybe 800 kilos, quite capable of biting off a man's face. So, Magus biologus, how do we catch a Carnadon? She asked, heaving on the wheel. Drusha looked up. We're going rather fast, Max, he said. Another call? Yes, she replied. Another breach of curfew? He asked. Max shook her head. Question stands, Valentin. How do we catch a Carnadon? The Habs were clustered together at the northern extremity of the town, gathered in tight, conspiratorial knots. Acres of wasteland surrounded each stack, littered with the flotsam of war and poverty. Much of the intense fighting during the Civil War had taken place in this shell-damaged suburb. Max slowed the transporter and guided it between piles of shattered bricks. They were approaching one of the most ramshackle towers. Ahead, the lamps picked out a pair of Magistratum transporters parked near the stack's loading dock. A heavy morgue carrier was pulling up beside them, its rear hatch gaping. "Come on," Max said. Drusha got out into the cold pre-dawn air. The rectangular hab stood stark against a sky, slowly paling into a gold sheen. He smelled the sweet rot of garbage and the unpleasant odor of wet rockcrete. "Bring your stab light," she said, making off across the rough ground to the group of Magistratum officers waiting by the stack entrance. She spoke to a couple of them, then signaled Drusha to follow her. They entered the wide doorway and began to climb the crude stairwell. "They've held off so you can get the first look at the scene," she said. Drusha took a deep breath. They climbed to the fifth floor. "Hurry up," she called back to him. "Hang on," he said. Drusha stooped to examine the rough wall, touching a dark patch among the lichen with his fingertips, and then sniffing them. "You'll catch something," Max said, coming back down the stairs to join him. "I thought that's why you hired me," he said. "Smell this. Ammonia, very strong. Other natural chemicals. Pheromones. This is a territorial mark. The animal spranted here." "What?" "It scent marked the wall with urine."
"And you wanted me to sniff it?"
Drusha looked up at her. "It's textbook felid behavior. The stain suggests quantity, so we're looking at something large."
"Carnadon?"
"It fits."
"See if this fits, too," she said.
The derelict habstack had become home for vagrants, and it was rare for these dispossessed souls to have any contact with the Magistratum. But one of them had been scared enough to raise the alarm, having heard a commotion on the fifth floor. The stack apartment was a four-room affair, a kitchen diner, a bed vault, a lounge, and a washroom cubicle. The place stank of mildew. And another smell Drusha hadn't encountered since Outer Udar. Blood. The Magistratum crew had set up pole lamps to mark the scene, and it had been picted and recorded.
"Watch your step," Max said.
As they went in, the smell became more intense. The corpse was in the lounge area. Even Max, hardened to the uglier aspects of life, had to turn aside for a moment. The body was that of an older female. The legs, swathed in filthy hose and support stockings, were intact. The torso had been stripped down to the bones, and these had been broken open so that something feeding could get at the soft organs. There was no head, no arms.
"They tell me the head's in there," Max said, indicating the kitchen area.
Drusha peered in through the doorway, glimpsing a brown, cracked object that looked like a broken earthenware pot, except that it still had a residue of grey hair.
"What's this?" Max called.
In the bedroom, her torch beam was illuminating a brown, fractured stick.
"Arm bone," said Drusha. "Broken open to get at the marrow."
He was remarkably composed. This was perhaps the most horrific sight that had ever greeted his eyes, but a professional detachment was masking his revulsion. The Magos biologist in him was fascinated by the killing.
"I think she was already dead," he said. "This is scavenging. A decent post-mortem will be able to confirm it. The feeder was big, but it took its time. Leisurely feeding, reducing the cadaver piece by piece, going for the most nutritional areas first. There was no struggle, no kill, although the Carnodon probably made quite a bit of noise as it rendered down the carcass.
"Carnodon," she said. "You're sure?" "I'd stake my professional credentials on it," he replied, "for what that's worth."
"All right," Max breathed heavily. "Can we get them in to hear this?"
"Yes," Drusha said.
"And can you work up something? I don't know, a library picked, maybe one of your dandy watercolor sketches, so we know what we're looking for."
"Glad to," he replied.
"Good," Max said. "You look like you need sleep."
He shrugged. "Where is the magistratum putting me up?" he asked. Max replied.
"We'll find somewhere."
Somewhere turned out to be a torn couch in the empty room next door to Max's office. It appeared from the stale bedclothes that someone else had been sleeping there on a regular basis. Drusha was too tired to complain. Besides, as far as his relationship with the planet Gershom went, this was pretty much par for the course. He fell asleep within minutes of lying down. He woke with a start, and found he'd only been sleeping for a couple of hours. It was barely dawn. As was often the case, rest had freed up his mind, and there was now an idea buzzing around in it so busily it had woken him. He felt strangely energized. After years of tedious dead-end employment, he was finally calling on his primary area of expertise again, using old skills that he had begun to believe had long since atrophied. He almost felt like a Magos biologist. Drusha got up, tucked in his shirt, and put on his shoes. The building was quiet and dead. He went into the hallway and tapped on the door of Max's office. When he got no reply, he let himself in, and started to rummage among the dossiers piled on the wire carts. He heard a metallic click behind him, and turned. Max, her hair tousled, stood behind the desk. The sidearm she had aimed at him was slowly lowering.
"It's you," she grunted,
her eyes puffy with sleep.
"Throne," he said. "Where were you?"
Rubbing her face, she gestured at the floor behind the desk, where Drusha could now see a few seat cushions and a crumpled blanket.
"You were sleeping on the floor under your desk," he said.
She cleared her throat and holstered the sidearm in her belt pouch. She looked pissed off and weary.
"Well, you got my bed, didn't you?" she snapped.
"Oh," he said. Max picked up her boots and shuffled across to the office door. She leaned out and yelled,
"Watch, officer! 2 caffeines before I shoot someone!"
Then she sat down on the rug and started to pull on her footwear.
"What time is it?"
she asked Drusha, grumpily.
"Early yet. I'm sorry. What were you doing?"
"I wanted to check the autopsy files. From the victims. There was something I wanted to look at."
"That pile there," Max said.
"No, the other end." Drusha started to look through the files, wincing at some of the more grisly pics he encountered. Max left the room, presumably to kill whoever it was that was being slow with the caffeine. When she returned, he'd spread a dozen of the dossiers out on the rug, and was making notes with the slate and stylus he'd borrowed from her desk.
"Max," he began, "there's something here that—"
"Get your jacket." In daylight, though daylight was a loose term, Tycho didn't look any better. From the side window of the speeding transporter, Drusha could now starkly see what had been merely spectral ruins the night before. There had been a melancholy air to the place in the darkness. Now everything was blunt and crass. The scars of fire, the pitting of assault weapons, the water-filled cavities of craters, the shock fractures on slabs of rockcrete. Weeds fumed the city ruins, thick and unlovely, reclaiming the waste ground between tenements and sacks. The gardens of Tycho were everywhere now, Drusha thought. The wild was reclaiming the city. They drove in convoy with 2 other magistratum vehicles, rattling down the empty thoroughfares.
"Fresh kill," was all Max would say. "In the commission of works."
Falcon was already on site, with 4 armed troopers in tow. Drusha wouldn't have been able to tell that the building before him was the commission of works. Penetrator shells had caved in the facade, and chewed curiously geometric shapes out of the roof. The rear of the building was a dark cave system of intact rooms.
"In here,"
said Falcon, shouldering his riot gun and leading them into the mangled ruins.
"Routine sweep. Picked it up about 30 minutes ago."
They clambered over fallen beams, disturbing the thick white dust. The body lay in a nest of broken floorboards.
"Civilian volunteer," Falcon said. "He was on a registered night watch here. He had a weapon, but it doesn't seem like he got the chance to use it."
The man lay on his side, facing them as they approached, with a face that was no longer there. Something had severed his skull laterally in a line from the point of the chin to the apex of the skull. It looked to Drusha like an anatomical crosscut picked from a surgery text manual. Drusha knelt down beside the body. The linear precision of the bite was baffling. "Did you sweep?" Max was asking Falcon.
"A brief look. Rambo thinks he heard something."
Max looked up at the trooper.
"Really?"
"Up at the back, ma'am," Rambo said. "There was definitely something moving around. I think it's still here."
"Is that likely?"
Max asked Drusha.
He shrugged. "If it was disturbed before it could feed." "I suppose so."
"Let's go," she ordered. She and Falcon moved ahead, weapons lowered.
"Valentin, you're up," she called back. "Stick with Edvin. The rest of you cover the front. Rambo, show us where."
They moved into the dark, crumbling hulk of the ruin, every footstep kicking up dust. Falcon, Rambo, and Max made their way up a staircase that was hanging off the remains of a supporting wall. Edging forwards with the trooper named Edvin, Drusha could hear the others walking around on the floor above, creaking the distressed floor, sifting dust down at them in hourglass trickles. Drusha could also hear Edvin's vox, turned low.
"To your left now."
That was Falcon.
"Don't get too far ahead," Max replied.
"Something? No, false alarm."
Edvin glanced nervously at Drusha.
"All right there, sir," he asked.
Drusha nodded.
"Some kind of cat?" the trooper asked. "Some kind,"
Drusha replied. He was becoming very aware of the beat of his own heart. When it happened with such ferocity and speed, Drusha barely had time to react. There was a fantastic, booming detonation. In hindsight, presumably Falcon's riot gun discharging, swiftly followed by a series of pistol shots on auto. At the same time, the vox went mad with strangulated calls. The floor above Drusha shook with a violent frenzy. There was an impact, a crash, a scream. Two more blasts from a riot gun.
"What the throne?"
Edvin began, raising his weapon and looking up. The floor above them caved in. Drusha and Edvin were knocked flat and almost buried in a cascade of broken joists, planks, and falling bricks. Mortar dust filled the atmosphere like a fog, choking and stifling. Another gunshot. Drusha struggled to his feet, pushing the broken floorboards off his legs. He could barely breathe. Edvin was on his face, unconscious. Something heavy had come straight down through the floor and landed on him, half crushing him. Drusha blinked.
"No!"
he cried. The something heavy was the body of a magistratum trooper, faceless, blood jetting forcibly from severed arteries. The blood sprayed up the walls, gleaming like rubies in the dust.
"Max!"
he cried.
"Max!"
He tried to reach her, though he knew it was far too late. Then something else came down through the hole in the floor, something fast and dark and feral. It was the animal, the killer, trying to find an escape route. It slammed Drusha over hard with one flailing limb, and he crashed into a plasterboard wall that shattered like old marzipan icing. For a moment, just a fleeting second before he passed out, he glimpsed it. The shape. The shape. He came round, staring up at Falcon's face.
"He's all right."
Falcon spat and turned away, wiping dust off his face. Drusha sat up fast, his head pounding.
"Max! Max!"
"What?"
she asked. Drusha saw her, crouching in the rubble in front of him. Falcon was getting the dazed Edvin back on his feet.
"Max!"
She was leaning over the body. Drusha got up and could see now the mutilated corpse was Rambo.
"It got away," Max murmured. "It got Rambo, and then it got away."
Falcon was shouting for the other troopers to sweep the rear of the building.
"What happened?"
Drusha asked.
"I didn't see it," Max said. Falcon saw something move and fired. Then it all went to hell.
It came down this way after it had... Drusha paused. It followed Rambo's body down.
You see it?
I didn't get a proper look, Drusha said.
Max cursed and walked away. Drusha crouched down beside the trooper's body and turned it slightly so he could look at the wound. The same clean, ghastly cut right across the face. But this time, a second one, abortive, made behind the line of the excising blow, as if the predator had been in a frenzy, alarmed perhaps, and had made a first hasty strike before following it up. Even so, the first strike, deep and into the side of the neck and head, would have killed Rambo outright. But even in haste, so clean, so straight. A cat. A cat did that. Drusha looked around. Edvin, blood dribbling from a cut above his left eye, was staring at his friend's body.
That's what the experts say, Drusha replied.
They drove back to the Magistratum HQ in silence. The sweep had picked up nothing. The killer had melted into the ruins beyond the commission of works as fast as frost in summertime.
You thought it was me, didn't you? Max asked finally.
What?
The body. I heard you cry out.
You thought it had got me.
Drusha nodded. He felt they might be about to have a moment, something honest that approximated intimacy. He was prepared to admit how much he would care if anything happened to her.
If you can't tell the difference between me and a hairy-assed male trooper, she said, I'm not holding out much hope for your observational expertise.
He looked over at her.
Screw you too, Max.
She left him alone in her office and let him get on with sorting the dossiers. A staffer brought him a cup of something over-brewed and over-sweetened late in the afternoon. By then he was pinning things to the walls and had switched to paper to make his notes. He accessed Max's cogitator and called up some city plan maps. Max came back just as it was getting dark outside.
I'm glad you're here, he said. There's something I need to show you.
She seemed cheerful, upbeat.
Something I have to show you first, she said.
Max led him down to the morgue. A crowd of officers and uniformed staffers had gathered, and there was almost a party atmosphere. Falcon was passing around bottles of contraband Amasek so everyone could take a slug.
Here he is, Falcon cried. Magos biologist Drusha.
There was some clapping.
Drusha,
Drusha said.
Whatever,
Falcon said, putting his arm around Drusha's shoulders.
Couldn't have done it without you, friend. Really, you were on the money. Hey, what do you think? Is this,
Carnadon, Drusha said, painfully aware of how big Falcon was beside him, squeezing him in the hug. The felid had been laid across four gurneys, heavy and limp in death. Its tusked snout seemed to grimace, as if it, like Drusha, wished it was somewhere else. Small, dark punctures in its belly showed where Falcon had shot it.
May I?
Drusha asked, and Falcon let him go over and examine the beast. The crowd turned back to toasting and laughing. It had once been a wonderful thing. Master of its world, afraid of nothing. An apex predator. Drusha smiled sadly as he thought of the phrase. A big specimen, too. Maybe 5.5 meters body length, 900 kilos healthy body weight. But at the time of its miserable hunted death, it had been less than 600 kilos, emaciated, its ribs poking out like tent braces. It was old, too, post-mature. The coat was raddled by sarcoptic mange and laden with lice, fungus, and parasites. Drusha ran his hand along its flank anyway. So knotted, gristly, starved. He peeled back the black lips and examined the dentition.
"Where did you get it?"
he called out to Falcon.
"In the cellars, under the lexicon," Falcon said, coming over. "We got a heads up. We'd circulated your picture, you see. Thanks for that. I went in, saw it, and boom, boom!"
Drusha nodded.
"Truth be told," Falcon said, dropping his voice. "He didn't put up much of a fight. But I wasn't taking any chances."
"I understand." Falcon turned back to the crowd.
"For Oni Rambo, poor bastard," he cried. "This one's for you, son."
Falcon offered the nearest bottle to Drusha. Drusha shook his head.
"Thanks for your help, Drusha," Falcon said.
Drusha, Max came over.
"I want to thank you on behalf of the division, Valentin," she said. "You got us our result. I'll bill the administratum for a whole week. Fair enough? Go get your things together. Someone will drive you home this evening."
Drusha nodded.
"I have a transporter waiting," Max said.
Drusha's bags were in a neat stack beside the office door. He was closing the last of the dossiers and sliding them back onto her carts.
"Right," he said. "Well, it's been good to have you on board." "Thanks." "Like old times, right?"
"Like Outer Udar, Max. I get the distinct impression you remember that more fondly than I do."
"Things will work out, Valentin," she said.
"Before I go," he said, "I'd like you to look at something."
"What?"
"Let's put it this way. I'd hate to have you come up all the way to the coast to get me again." Max frowned.
"What are you on about now?"
"The killer wasn't...
isn't...
that cat." Max wiped her hand across her lips as if encouraging patience.
"Go on."
"I said from the start it wasn't an animal.
You also told me to look for a Carnodon."
"Let me show you something," Drusha said. He held up a data slate. The compact screen showed a display of the city, overlaid with rune symbols. "I've done some collating. See here, I've mapped all the sites where the victims were found. 32 bodies.
I did that myself, on an ongoing basis. I saw nothing. No pattern, no discernible spread."
"I agree," said Drusha. "I mean, there's a certain concentration of kill sites here, in this crescent, but most of the others are too wayward, too random."
"So?"
"That first body you showed me, in the morgue. So cleanly, so particularly cut. Minimal signs of feeding, if any at all. Just like the body today in the Commission of Works. And Rambo."
"Right, the face bitten off."
Drusha nodded.
"Yes, except I don't think it was bitten. Remember how clean I said it was? I mean, almost sterile. None of the bacterial traces one would expect from an animal bite. Especially not from an old, diseased predator with gums receding from vitamin deficiency. Max, I could wiggle that poor cat's teeth out with my fingers."
Her face had gone hard.
"Keep going, Valentin," she said.
"The body in the stacks we went to look at. That was the work of the Carnodon. It had mauled and eaten the corpse away. I checked the autopsy files. 9 of the cases were just like that, gnawed. The victims were all either dead already or helpless. Old, infirm. The Carnodon had escaped from the zoological gardens, but it was weak and long past its hunting prime. It roamed the city, not preying, but scavenging. That was all it could do anymore."
"What are you telling me?" Max asked quietly.
"Look at the map again. Here." Drusha flipped a switch. "Now I've taken away the bodies I can attribute to the cat."
"Cleans it up a bit, doesn't it?"
"Yes," she admitted. "The old Carnodon was hungry and opportunistic. It had no pattern. It just roamed and fed where it could. What we're left with is a much more precise zone, almost territorial. The killings here were like poor Rambo, swift, savage, clean, no feeding. But it's still an odd crescent-shaped spread. How can we triangulate from that?
Look at the map, Max. Territory is determined not just by hunter, but also by prey. The crescent-shaped dispersal covers an area east of the Commission of Works. There are none to the west, because that's an area interdicted by the Martial Order Division. It doesn't kill there, Max, because there's no one there to kill."
"Oh, Thrawn," she murmured. "And this is the good bit." Drusha smiled. "Look what happens when I mirror the dispersal, projecting it as if there were quarry in all directions. The crescent becomes
a circle."
"Right,
a circle. There's your focus.
There's your bloody pattern.
That's its territory. Right there."
Max was driving faster than ever. In the back seat sat Edvin and a trooper called Roderin. Both were checking their riot gun loads.
"You sure about this?" Max hissed.
"I've very little left to stake on it," Drusha replied, "my professional credentials being long since used up."
"Don't get smart," she warned.
"You two ready?"
she called over her shoulder. Edvin and Roderin both replied in the affirmative. Edwin leaned forwards.
"I thought we'd got this thing, sir," he said. "I mean, I thought Falcon had plugged it."
"He got the cat," Drusha said. "But the cat wasn't it." Max began to slow down, and it was lucky she did. A second magistratum transporter swung out in front of them from a side street and ploughed ahead.
"Falcon,"
Max whispered. They pulled up outside the Commission of Works. Falcon had two troopers with him, Levy and Mantegna.
"What the hell is this about?"
Falcon asked belligerently. He was still half drunk from the party in the morgue. "We're on to a lead," Max said. "Behave." Falcon looked at Drusha.
"I got it. Stone dead. Boom, boom. What is this crap now?"
"Something else?" Drusha said. They spread out in a line, entering the weed-choked waste behind the Commission of Works. "Max," Drusha called. She came over to him.
"I'd like a weapon."
"In the old days, you..."
"I'd really like a weapon," he repeated.
Max nodded and lowered her riot gun in one hand as she pulled the handgun from her holster. She handed it to him. "The safety's by... I know how they work," he snapped. They pushed on. "So, this is all about territory, right?" she said.
Drusha nodded.
"You saw the map. We're entering its territory now. It's hunting ground."
"How can you be so sure?"
"Like I said, you saw the map. The thing is, we're not talking about animal instinct. Not territory as a predator would understand it. We're talking about orders."
"What? Orders? What is this place, Max?"
"The Commission of Works. And what's behind it?"
"Just rubble, Valentin."
"Yeah, but what was it before it was rubble?" "It was the main building of the Administratum here in Tycho. Before the tank shells leveled it."
"Exactly. The Administratum Center. Dead center of the spread pattern. During the Civil War, something was ordered to guard that vital point, secure it, defend it."
Max glared at him.
"A man?"
Drusha shrugged.
"Something. Something that's still doing it.
Max, I glimpsed the killer in the Commission of Works, right after it killed Rambo. It was humanoid." Spread wide, the line of officers entered the ruins of the Administratum. Some parts of the ruin were two or three stories tall, held up, crippled and crooked, by the ferro-steel bars stripped through the rockcrete. There were weeds everywhere, flourishing. Tinsel barb and frondwort, cabbage speculus and the limp foliage of climbing tracidae. The air was pungent with root rot, stagnant water, mould. Drusha slowly circled around. Max was nearby, riot gun raised. He glanced left and saw Falcon bending in under a broken doorway. To his right, Edwin was aiming his weapon at the overhung, plant-swathed walls. Levy raised his clucking Auspex box.
"Getting something. Very weak. It's coming from the west."
Falcon nodded and disappeared. Max hurried onwards. Mantegna covered her, glancing nervously up at the blooming foliage. Weapon clenched high, Roderin shuffled through a ruined archway.
"Getting hot now. Getting really hot,"
Levy called, lifting up his Auspex, which was burring like a cicada.
"Throne, it must be right on us."
Falcon's gun went off. Once, twice, then another one echoed it. Max started forward, running, and Drusha followed. Levy was right behind them. Mantegna rushed around to the other side of the wall. There was a scream. Two more shots. Three. Mantegna was dead. He had been sliced open from the scalp to the sternum. Blood was still spitting from his opened body, high into the air.
"Throne!"
Max cried, turning around. She heard Falcon fire again, then Edwin.
"Where is it? Where is it?"
Levy almost crashed into her from behind, following his Auspex blindly.
"Right there! There!"
Max aimed and fired, once, twice, grinding back the slide each time. She put a huge hole in the facing wall. Shots again, distant, from Falcon and Edwin. Max and Levy followed the sound. Pistol raised, Drusha turned the other way. This predator was smart. Very smart and very able. It knew all about misdirection. It could outthink any regular human and then split him open. It understood military tactics because that is what it dealt in. It had been programmed. It had been given orders. Breathing hard, Drusha edged around another shattered arch, his weapon braced. His pulse was racing, but this felt entirely odd. This wasn't about his trained skills any more. This wasn't about an animal whose habits and behaviors he had been schooled to understand. This was the opposite. So he did the opposite. Facing any hungry predator, the last thing a Magos biologist would want to do is step into the open. But he did so, turning a full circle, his pistol aimed in both hands. On the rubbled floor before him, he saw Roderin. Roderin was dead, just like the others. Drusha circled again, weapon tight. The killer flew at him. Drusha pulled the trigger and kept it pulled. 8, 9, 10 rounds, the full clip boomed out of Max's borrowed sidearm and hit the killer head-on. It fell, burst open, broken, puffed pink intestines spilling from its punctured torso. A man, but not a man. A product of the Civil War. Augmetically strengthened, augmetically wired, its eyes a black visor, wires stapled into its flesh, its palsied hands curled over to expose the whirring chain blades sewn into its wrists. The chain blades whined as they came together. Despite the rounds he had put into it, it got back up and leapt at Drusha's face. His gun clicked, dry. "Down, Valentin!" From behind him, Max fired her riot gun, and the killer's head burst like a tomato. The impact knocked it sideways. When it landed, its chain blades were still whirring involuntarily.
"All right?" she asked Drusha. He nodded. "You were right, as ever.
Glad to be of service."
"Seriously," she said, leading him out of the ruins as Falcon and Edvin fired shot after shot into the killer to make sure it was dead. "Seriously, Drusha, I owe you."
"A week's pay," he said.
"I do what I do." He began to walk away, picking his path through the rubble.
"Valentin, I could put it down as 2 weeks. No one would know."
He shrugged. He looked back at her.
"What about a ticket off this rock?" he said, with a thin, sad smile. "Can't afford that," she said. "Sorry."
"Budgets and all." "I had to ask," said Drusha. He sat down on a chunk of bricks.
"Look," said Max. "You've seen how stretched things are down here. The Martial Order Division can barely keep up. We can use all the help we can get, particularly sharp, educated minds with a thing for details. What do you think?"
"How would that work?" Drusha asked. Max shrugged.
"Not sure. I could probably second your services on a temporary basis using the emergency powers. It's not much, I know, but..."
Drusha frowned. "My teaching post isn't much, but at least it's safe." He handed her back the pistol.
"You sure?" she asked. "Whenever I spend any time with you, Max, it ends up getting exciting," he said. "Rather too exciting for a man of my disposition." "Hey," she replied, as if hurt.
"I haven't gotten you killed so far," Drusha smiled. "So far." Max nodded.
"All right," she said.
She kissed him briefly on the cheek and turned to walk back to the transporters. Every wrong turn destiny had ever offered him. And which was this? Drusha sighed. "Max," he called out.
"Yes?"
"Would I get my own desk?"
Turning back, she smirked. "Valentin, you'll even get your own couch."
Drusha got to his feet and wandered down the path after her. That was Gardens of Tycho, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth. The Keeler Image, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth. Medonai the Eater, so called because of his appetites, had declared an auction, and word of this sale brought dealers and speculators from across the subsector, despite the isolation of his home. An item in the catalogue drew my attention. I sent an agent in advance to confirm the provenance, and when word came back to me that it seemed authentic, I made arrangements to attend the sale in person. Medonai the Eater dwelt on a war-burned rock called Palik,
Its orbit and revolutions blessed Palak with a complex and irregular pattern of days and nights, some long, some short, some bright, some dim, which had led to the publication of various thick zodiacs and ephemeris tracts. I was not much bothered with learning the names and durations of the day-night cycle. All I knew was that I should avoid the long and formidable Burn Day, a periodic event when all three suns rose together. Many of those attending the auction arrived by cutter and orbital boat, setting down in the bleak flats of the desert outside the sloping walls of Medinai's palace. Others came into the local city, Barit Prime, and then hired caravans to trek out to the palace, 600 kilometers beyond the city gates. Caravans made the trip almost daily, laden with goods from the city's produce markets. Such was Medinai's appetite. I sat down on a mesa, 5 kilometers from the palace, and made the way on foot. It was a low day, when only the second sun made an appearance in the heavens, and then only for a brief interval of 6.5 standard hours. It was cold and dry. Through my glare shields the sky was a deep, rich blue, and the sun a white ball that cast lens flare when I turned my head. Light glinted on the hulls of shuttles and cutters parked on their landing frames on the desert floor. I saw the thin dust plume of a caravan procession 15 kilometers out. The palace was of fair size. It was all that remained of a city that had been levelled by war. Portions of it sloped away into the desert sands in litters of rubble, suggesting that a great deal more of the ancient habitation lay below ground, or was, at least, buried in the bosom of history. Sentinels at the gatehouse watched me approach. "You come to Medinai?" asked one, his voice a vox hiss through his rebreather mask. Both of them were dressed in plate and body gear that had once been Astra Militarum issue, now repainted in the bright colours of a circus. "I do," I replied. "Your name?" "Gregor Eisenhorn," I replied. I saw no reason to lie. "And your standing?" I showed them my inquisitorial rosette. Neither blanched. "Have you come to purge us, sir?" one of them laughed. "I don't know," I answered. "Has anyone here denied the sanctity of the throne?" "Not us," chuckled the other. "We are all obedient to Holy Terra here, all of us." "Then my business is purely to bid and buy," I said. I was admitted. The entry halls of the palace were busy with visitors. Each one, it seemed, had brought an ample entourage. Medinai's servitors were conveying trays of food and drink from the kitchens. Each new dish announced by a liveried chamberlain, who declared the name of the delicacy as though it were another guest at the proceedings. I was offered a flask of water, a ritual gift for any traveller arriving out of the desert, which I took, and a beaker of wine that I did not. Various lots from the forthcoming sale had been set on display throughout the halls so that they could be viewed. I saw prayer wheels from the long graves of Thracian, diadems from the slave worlds, a fine bust of St. Kiodrus, still in its satin-lined box, and a good oil of Gilliman, done by Manxis of Eustace Majoris, or so the ticket stated. The composition was well enough, but the brushwork lacked the finesse of Manxis himself. I thought that most likely it was a copy, or the work of his school. I was admiring it when a voice at my shoulder said, "I know why you're here." I turned. "I am Medinai," the man said. He was tall, slender, smiling, dressed in a green body glove and half cloak. He wore what might be described as too much jewelry, including a tiara of pearl and crystal. "You are Medinai?"
"I am, in fact, his mouth," the man said. His smile was alarmingly broad. "He speaks through me, and I conduct his business."
"You are his proxy, or an avatar?" I asked.
"An avatar," he replied.
The tiara and the rings, I realized,
were part of a more extensive suite of telekine systems that allowed Medinai to puppet the man and operate through him.
"You are Gregor Eisenhorn,"
he said.
"Of the Orders."
"I am."
"Your reputation precedes you. There can be only one item in this sale that would attract an individual such as yourself. Would you like to see it?"
He led me to a side chapel. The low-day sun fell pale through the bars of the tall windows. The object stood on a pedestal, protected by light screens. It was a vitreous plate, milled in plastic, about a third of a meter square.
"Magnificent, isn't it, sir?"
Medinet's mouth said. It was the most appalling thing I had ever seen. "Exquisite."
"I'll leave you to enjoy it,"
he said. I wasn't alone in the room. Several other visitors were viewing the piece. One was a hard-set man with extensive augmetic optics suited into his skull.
"Quite a thing,"
he mused.
"Indeed,"
I replied.
"Genuine,"
he added. His optics whirred.
"I can gauge the age of the glass, the plastic sheath. The format of the plate matches the kind she was known to use. A miracle beyond measure that something so fragile could have survived so long when so much else perished."
"Truly," I agreed.
"But even more," he went on, "the image itself, the composition. She had an extraordinary eye as a remembrancer. I doubt any soul in the Imperium has ever matched her skill at the capture of Picts."
"This they say of her," I said. "An exceptional gift. Which is why she was chosen, of course, for the expedition."
"To think," he sighed, "that someone had that kind of superlative talent, beyond any before or since, and yet that is still not the thing she is most famous for."
He looked at me. His optics clicked and buzzed.
"What do you think?"
he asked.
"Do you think the most incredible thing about it is that it is an original Pict, made 10,000 years ago by the hallowed founder of the Imperial Truth? Or that it is a Pict of Horus Lupercal?"
"I think the most incredible thing about it," I replied, "is that it is sitting on sale here, and not sequestered in a vault on far-off Terra." Euphrates Keeler was a remembrancer. In the last years of the Great Crusade, armed with a good eye and a picta, she had been appointed to the 63rd Expeditionary Force to observe and record the operation of the Lunar Wolves. Her work was remarkable. Her fame spread. The War Master himself regarded her with favor. In that distant age, the God Emperor had decreed that the operation of the Imperium should be documented by artists and historians to make a chronicle of the foundation of the Age of Man. Such had been the mindset then, that the great work of engineering a civilization should be honestly, freely, and independently recorded. That does not sound like the Emperor I know. Such freedom ended, of course, in the atrocities that followed, in the years of bloodshed we now call the Heresy War. Keeler was present on the ground at the start of it. She was a witness to the first acts of bloodshed. She stood in time at the zero point where history turned a corner, and she did so with a picta in her hand, capturing that transformation. Her story did not end there. She so easily might have been one of the trillions extinguished in the fires that followed. Her name is not commonly known today, except that it is, as Saint Euphrates. She was blessed with divine grace and gifts, and from her, and those few close to her in those bleak years, the essence of the Imperial Creed was born. She was one of the first saints. From her,
and those disciples around her arose the tenets of the Laetitia Divinitatis, the truth of us all, that the Emperor of mankind is not a man, but a god. It is through her that the truth was recognized. It was in her that our faith was born. The man with the optics was called Sejan Karil. We returned to the main halls and sat together, talking of what we had seen. "The pict itself isn't the price, you know," he said. "It is beyond value," I said. "An image of Lupercal, in life, before he fell. The beauty and strength of his visage speak to the depth of the catastrophe that occurred. Some might say that none should look upon it, ever," he said. "Who might say that?"
"The Inquisition," he replied, "of which, I hear, you are a part."
"I believe it should be seen," I said, "as a warning, to show how even the greatest perfection can be blackened, to refresh our determination to guard against the dark." He shrugged. "If," he said, "it is Horus before he fell." "You think it after?"
"Would that not be a stranger lesson, if that was his face after Chaos stole him? Chaos hides its nature well."
"You say it's not the prize," I said, changing the subject.
"According to the catalogue," he said, "it comes with notes. Some frail documents written in her hand, describing the image and the circumstances of its capture."
"You've seen them?"
Karil shook his head. "They are reserved for the successful buyer alone, but I have heard of their contents."
"I had too, naturally. That was partly why I had come. It was said the notes were revelatory, that they showed, in Keeler's own authenticated script, that she considered Horus a man, not a transformed demonic being. Further, they related that it had been commonly known at the time that the Emperor denied his divinity. He had formally declared that he was not a god, and sought to suppress the notion that he was. The Laetitia Divinitatis was already growing back then. The notes showed that the Emperor wanted it prescribed and forbidden. They showed that the Emperor did not believe himself to be a god. Keeler and her companion saints had created the foundation of imperial faith against the Emperor's express wishes. That was a different kind of heresy, and I wasn't sure if the heretic was Keeler or, somehow, the Emperor himself. "There's no way to know the truth," I said.
"The truth is in the writing," said Karil.
"The danger," I corrected him. "For truth is arbitrary. It's what people will do with it. If one, shall we say, stood against the imperial truth, one might use a pict and manuscript from such an august and exceptional source as the basis for a new creed,
to undermine the faith and deny the Emperor's divinity."
"It is not reaching to imagine so."
"And that, I presume, is why the Inquisition is here, to seize the image and remove that possibility."
"I never said why I was here," I replied.
"Not you."
He nodded gently in the direction of a woman on the far side of the hall. She was talking with other guests.
"Halanor Curtex," said Karil. "Ordo Hereticus, so I am told."
"If the Ordo Hereticus wanted the Keeler image," I replied, "they would have stormed the palace, taken it, put all within to the sword, and leveled the site from orbit."
"Maybe," he said. "Unless they wanted to find out who was interested first, to observe the individuals a relic of this kind brings out of the woodwork."
He was right. I had thought as much. The sale was private, but it was still bait of the first magnitude. From my seat, I could see at least 6 persons of interest from the Ordo watchlists: renegades, recidivists, and heretics,
lured into the open by the mouth-watering promise of a truly blasphemous artifact. If I had been in control of Ordo Hereticus operations, I would have stayed my hand, planted agents in the palace, and waited for the sale. Then, in one stroke, I would have taken possession of the heretical image, and also ended a dozen key enemies of the Imperium, possibly obtaining enough information via torture and interrogation to bring down most of the cult networks in the subsector. In a way, that was why I had come. I didn't want the Keeler image. I wanted to see it, but I had no desire to own it. It was too dangerous to exist. I had come to see who the offering of it might bring out. One, in particular. And I was sure I had found her. Caryl, with his sharp